A young perspective on hot-button issues around the world. This is The Hub.
Hello and welcome to The Hub on CGTN, I'm Wang Guan in Beijing. This year marks the 70th anniversary of China's National People's Congress and the 75th anniversary of China's Political Consultative Conference. Throughout the years and decades, these unique Chinese systems have evolved and been refined, adapting to the changing times and practical needs. As China has just published this 2024 agenda, what are the most significant priorities on the agenda during this year's two sessions? What outcomes will be reached? How will China meet its domestic and international challenges? To discuss all these, I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Li Cheng. He's the director of Center on Contemporary China and the World at Hong Kong University. Dr. Li, it's so good to see you. It's wonderful to have you back on the show.
Well, very nice to be here.
Dr. Li, China convenes its annual legislative and political advisory sessions. What are the key policy signals that you're watching this year?
Traditionally, two sessions always emphasize on economy and the people's livelihood. And this is a very interesting moment in China's economic development. On the one hand, not only China, but the entire world confront major economic challenges for a number of reasons, and some are shared, some are not shared. But China is determined to recover earlier compared with the rest of the world, partly because China maintains stability, and partly China emphasizes certain areas which China have advantage. For example, digital economy, IT platform, and new energy, particularly EV. And also China emphasized on Guangdong, Hong Kong, Macau, Great Bay Area, along with Beijing and Shanghai. These are the three clusters among the top 10 global technology clusters. So China is well positioned. But of course, that China confront the pressure on employment and particularly young people. I think this is the meeting that they wanted to emphasize China's age or China's advantage, try to overcome some of the problems, but also enhance the people's confidence.
Yeah, Dr. Li, over the past few months, a theory is gaining traction in the Western world that is China peak. Do you agree with that assessment?
Of course, I do not agree. I mean, the whole thing is completely wrong. You look at the statistic, China has the $18 trillion US dollars economy. It's based on a nominal term, but if it's by PPP, it will be $35 trillion. China is ranked number two economy in terms of GDP. Of course, also go back to PPP will be the first. The growth rate is still pretty good. Last year, it's 5.2%. And also you see the rise of a middle class, the GDP per capita also grow very, very strongly. Now I want to share with you that the so-called China peak, it's not the first time, many times, and especially for example, 1989, I remember this is the first time I returned to China after I came to US to study in 1985. Yeah. The airplane was almost empty. This is early 1990. I went to Tsinghua University to study rise of the Chinese engineers, particularly in the leadership, which we call technocrats. And so that's the things that when I observed, I thought that the Chinese leadership probably will increasingly recruited for this pool, engineers and natural scientists and et cetera. Certainly I was right. And also 10 years later in the middle of 1997, I wrote a book based on my 2 years work experience in China, talk about rise of a middle income group or middle class in Western term. But the book at first did not get past the reviewers, because all the reviewers said that this is there's no such a thing called the Chinese middle class or Shanghai middle class. But of course, we know now middle class has changed China, changed the world. China now is the largest middle class country with 400 million people. Last year, after Liang Hui, in the China Development Forum, I had the great opportunity to meet Premier Li Qiang. He said in a few years, China's middle class will reach 500 million. So that's a great opportunity. So I think China's best day is yet to come. International travel is still relatively low, but domestic travel already returned to normalcy. I mean, the Bay Area, I can tell you during the Spring Festival, about 2.5 million people both ways went from mainland, visit Hong Kong and Macau, and also about 2.5 million visit Hong Kong people visit the mainland. So it's a fascinating development. So now the Bay Area is booming, and every weekend, there's almost 500,000 Hong Kong people to go to Shenzhen to spend a weekend over there, from somewhere 300,000 people to 500,000 every week. Think about that, the tremendous potential for the country. So this is the things I wanted to mention. I do not want to mention about the technological development, the emphasis on innovation, e-commerce, and also new energy. These are all great opportunities for China's next phase of development.
Yeah, Dr. Li, talking about technology and AI in particular, what role do you see AI playing in the future of Chinese society and the Chinese economy?
Everything. We knew that the AI era will come, but very few people, maybe none of us, can recognize that it will come so quickly, so penetratingly. And it's changed everything. You look at the scale of the change, the speed of change, and the relying on skilled workers. These are all revolutionary. We are in the early stage of AI era. Now, the interesting thing is the Chinese government and put a lot of emphasis. Probably China is among some of the governments to have the AI strategy map or work plan. And also Chinese, very interesting, Chinese not just simply emphasize technology, but also put the technology as a part of innovation and also start to issue many regulations and norms and rules. And even I think we should emphasize on ethics. So I think that also as repeat the obvious, that the Chinese government also call for international cooperation in various areas, including war and peace. The interesting thing is that in San Francisco meeting, I think a potential landmark agreement is between President Xi and President Biden, talk about the human control, continuation of human control of use of nuclear weapon in the era of AI, because otherwise it will be a terrible, devastating situation. So I think I'm glad that two AI great powers form a consensus on this area. We probably will see more information about that agreement in the months to come.
Focus on what's relevant in China and the world. Bridge the gap between what you know and what you want to know. This is The Hub.
Dr. Li, there are challenges, though, facing the Chinese economy. If you look at the fact that tens of trillions of RMB's worth of savings have been added to Chinese households, while household consumption remains less than robust. And also for foreign companies, according to AmChamp and British Chamber and European Chamber, not a whole lot are leaving China, but they're not reinvesting as much or as expected. So what policy signals do you think these two sessions from the Chinese government can send to its domestic consumers, investors, as well as global investors, to really ensure that China is perceived as still a promising market to invest in?
I think it's a very, very important question. Now, of course, that the previous two-digit growth is over, and the previous model of economic development also largely over. China cannot be driven by property development, and the stock market, the IPO list will profoundly change in terms of global economy. And the Chinese leaders is right. China should be concerned about the risk in the financial sector. So that's actually explained. Chinese leaders wanted to have the financial reform and they wanted to emphasize financial risk, vulnerability. If you look at the previous meetings in the past couple of years, maybe even earlier, 6-7 years ago, President Xi Jinping already emphasized the need to deal with the risk at the China confronts. Financial risk is one of the top. Now, of course, the Chinese economy faces a series of challenges. Private sector needs to really have the new input and let them to play an important role. I hope this Liang Hui will emphasize the importance of the private sector role. Of course, Chinese leaders are aware of that. I was in last year's meeting in the China Development Forum, and Ding Xuexiang said that China needs to open, need to welcome foreign investment. China should be part of the international global economy. It's not a choice, it's a necessity. So these are the leadership emphasis. But still, with some challenges, the reason is not some people blame that the policy or a kind of overemphasis on the security. But I think the reason is complicated. On one hand, not China, the all countries emphasize security in today's world. Without security, how could you develop? But there's some other reasons. One is a structure change of Chinese economy. The so-called new normal now become a reality. Second is global economic slowdown. And also the so-called China past the peak and also overemphasize Taiwan, the risk of Taiwan street. These all play around in a way that the people are very much concerned about China's economy. Of course, that doesn't mean that the Chinese government should not do much. But on the other hand, we should put the issues in the global perspective, not just talk about the government policy. Now, of course, if government wanted to fix that problem, they still have some stimulus plans can apply. I actually favor this kind of stimulus plan, but we should also recognize if the stimulus plan still does not work, that I will tell you, this will tell us it's multiple reasons involved. They want to make sure that when you use definitely effective, at the moment, the cost for this stimulus plan probably is still it's a concern we need to figure out, China needs to figure out. So I think it's a comprehensive package, emphasize innovation, emphasize big consumption, middle class, middle income development, and also continue to promote foreign trade. China now waiver a lot of visas, a lot of countries' visas to China. This is a clear indication China wants to attract. But most importantly, actually, I would argue that in the world, many countries overly concerned about the security or stability in the country. China actually in relatively good shape because China and also China's Hong Kong both can maintain stability. Why we do not put more emphasis on economic development, which is in contrast to some of the countries obsessed with security issue. So that's my recommendation. I think certainly leaders may have some different concerns, or they certainly have far more information than other people like myself, like the media and et cetera. But the important thing is that you uplift confidence only through the economic recovery, and otherwise that you only delay that process. So I'm in favor of economic stimulus plan. I also believe that Chinese leadership have a lot of new policy can be implemented. I will be happy to go with the details. Yeah,
thank you so much for your diagnosis and advice. And on the Chinese path to modernization that is expected to be a key concept echoed and solidified during this year's two sessions, what do you think are the most prominent features of this Chinese path to modernization?
You see, the previously Chinese leader talk about socialism with Chinese characteristics. Also, there are several different variations. These are still valid, but now the emphasis on the modernization, which China want to be part of the modern world, want to be part of the international system, probably even could contribute in significant way. But it's also with a Chinese style, not Western style modernization, but the Chinese style, but it will be part of the global world, not against the modern, not against the global, but also take advantage of China's own strength, contribute that the new wave of globalization, new wave of modernization. One of the things is that the clean energy, environment development. Second is emphasize e-commerce. And the third is to not only to put the emphasis on poverty elimination. China certainly scored very, very well, but also to help more people to enter the middle class, the rank, the so-called common prosperity, eventually will stimulate the three engines of China's economic growth, which is investment, consumption, and foreign trade. At the moment, these faces some, all these three areas faces some challenges. This is the result of structural change. I think that if China continue to put emphasize, particularly promote private sector to let more people join that middle class rank, eventually will tell the world China is the largest market. China is an opportunity to resolve the problem, not the problem itself.
Dr. Li, thank you so much for your insights.
Thank you. Great to see you.
Focus, focus on what's relevant in China and the world. Bridge the gap between what you know and what you want to know. This is The Hub.
China's global trade footprint is expanding, and Africa, the youngest continent, is gaining gradual economic importance among key trading partners. I had the opportunity to interview Albert Mudenda Muchanga, the African Union Commissioner for Economic Development, Trade, Tourism, Industry, and Minerals. Join me as he shed lights on African perspectives on global trade and how the continent actively participates and benefits from Chinese initiatives and practices. Commissioner Muchanga, welcome to Shanghai, China.
Thank you very much.
And then we're into the second decade of the Belt and Road Initiative. We've just celebrated the first. How do you see the merits of the BRI going forward?
Belt and Road Initiative has contributed to opening up Africa through the development of infrastructure. A good example is the linkage between Djibouti and Ethiopia. Through that, Ethiopia has a very reliable source to external markets. They can move goods from Ethiopia to the rest of the world. They can move goods from the rest of the world to Ethiopia, and it can go on to other parts of Africa. Then you've got issues of telecommunications, which are very, very, very important. Then at the level of Africa wide, we are cooperating with China on the development of quality infrastructure. And through that, we are going to develop the Made in Africa standard. And when that label comes up, a company producing in Africa that gets to use the Made in Africa standard should meet certain criteria which are under development now. And we're doing so with the national regulatory agencies, standard agencies, so that there's buy-in right from the beginning. So these are some of the elements of cooperation which are emerging, and they're quite very useful. And they're going to build on the focus on industrialization, agricultural modernization, and talent development.
In Johannesburg, South Africa, the Chinese President Xi met with the leaders of Africa, including the leader of the African Union. This China-African dialogue session taking place on the sidelines of the BRICS summit. How do you look at the importance of that meeting?
Very important. I attended the meeting. That's where the President of China indicated that we should deepen collaboration in the three key areas of industrialization, agricultural modernization, and the talent development. And shortly after that, we had a meeting in Addis Ababa, where we are making the review of 10 years after Brexit. The Embassy of China to the African Union was able to bring in business people both from China and from within Africa. We have been investing, the Chinese people have been investing in China, to indicate their readiness to continue investing across Africa. So it's very, very, very good.
Well, what kind of partner do you see China in this process of Africa's building of its free trade area?
Well, a lot of companies from China, we encourage them to establish in Africa and use the natural resource endowments of Africa to produce at source. Can be in the green industrialization area, which is emerging and very, very, very important. It can be a production of food. It can be development of infrastructure and other connecting services. So that is most welcome. So there's a huge potential for increased investment from China in the various activities which are going to drive Africa's socio-economic development.
I know that you're representing many sectors, the business sector, the commercial sector, also tourism and
yes.
minerals.
Yes.
When it comes to tourism and travel, what do you hope to see happening going forward between China and Africa?
Well, quite a number of Chinese tourists would like to have the experience of visiting Africa, and they are most welcome. They will not be disappointed. We have a very huge variety of attractions there. Those who want to see the pyramids of Egypt, they are free to do that. Then there are offerings of wild safaris across Africa. Quite a lot of African countries have huge attractions of wild animals, lions, elephants, and others. Then the Victoria Falls, one of the seven wonders of the world. And for those who are adventurers, they can do some bungee jumping 400 meters down the Victoria Falls. So we have a lot to offer.
Focus, focus on what's relevant in China and the world. Bridge the gap between what you know and what you want to know. This is The Hub.
What kind of globalization does Africa need going forward?
Well, Africa is committed to the multilateral system. A majority of our member states are members of the World Trade Organization. Then over and above that, we have what we call the African Continental Free Trade Area, which is going to really, it is the foundation for building one African market. And the anchor to the African Continental Free Trade Area is to start by liberalizing 90% of goods and services across Africa so that within 10 to 15 years, they are duty-free. So that's how committed we are to openness. And to facilitate that, some of the measures which we've been attacking is to come up with a payments and the settlement system, where the daily settlements are going to be in local currencies with net settlement in foreign exchange. So we are going to reduce the usage of foreign exchange in intra-African trade. Then we also have a protocol on free movement of people, right of residence, right of establishment, which is going to facilitate visa-free travel of Africans across the continent. And those wanting to stay in different African countries other than their own, they should be able to do that. Already, Kenya has announced that, Rwanda has announced that they are going to facilitate visa-free. Then in order to harmonize policies and regulations, also have a policy and a protocol on investment, a protocol on competition policy, and a protocol on intellectual property rights. And then we are also facilitating the development of regional and continental value chains. Because with that, then we are going to ensure that there is a value addition within Africa, and we are going to use industrialization as the basis for the development of intra-African trade. Already, manufacturing is a major component of intra-African trade. 42% of intra-African trade is composed of manufacturers. The global average is 52%. We wanted to reach that global average.
Finally, on international relations, we've seen the expansion of BRICS taking place in Africa. We've seen the consolidation of Shanghai Cooperation Organization, APEC, coming forward. These organizations representing the global south, including the African continent, and increasing number of the countries there from Africa represented. How do you look at the future of the global south in counterbalancing the existing world order?
Well, the global south is emerging as an economic force, and that is to be expected. Because when we look at the world as it is now, most of the members of the global south were in the under colonial rule. And in addition to that, there was huge demand for social economic development. And the investments have been put in those areas to promote, in these regions, to promote socio-economic advancements. And when you have reached a certain level of economic development, that also goes with the responsibilities in the global arena. And that's why you find that quite a number of countries of the global south are in the G20. And for that very reason, not too long ago, the African Union was admitted as a permanent of the G20, which means that 100% of the African countries are in the G20. And when you look at the population of the countries of the G20, the issue of inclusivity comes in, because a majority of the population of the world comes from the global south.
Yeah, Africa is also the youngest continent.
In the world, yes. So in terms of inclusivity, certainly we see a great role for the global south in the emerging world order.
Commissioner Muchanga, thank you so much for your time. And that will do it for this edition of The Hub on CGTN. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Meng Wan in Beijing. I'll see you again next time.
The best military commander is not he who fights 100 battles and wins every one of them. The best military strategy does not lead to the desiccation of the enemy's capital city. Decoding the Art of War will help you understand why there's no art in war and how Sun Tzu stayed undefeatable using the science of war, with fun stories and insightful breakdown of famous battles. Tune in to Decoding the Art of War on Spotify.
Are you interested in learning Chinese?
I always tell my students that listening is the key to mastering the language. Check out Takeaway Chinese, where you can start learning the language quickly and enjoyably, no matter if you're a rookie or a sophisticated Chinese learner. There is definitely something that will interest you. Check out Takeaway Chinese. A world starts with 你好.